Welcome to the serialized short story audiobook collection, Bones Are White, by Scott Sigler. Get the stories in Bones Are White for all ebook readers at scottsigler.com/bonesarewhite, or from that same page as a full-length audiobook. You can also buy the ebook version directly from the Kindle Store, the Nook Store, Apple's iBooks, and from Google Play. This book contains harsh language, adult situations, and lots of violence. So if you're easily offended, cue up some Taylor Swift and enjoy.
Johnny, wake up! Johnny blinked his way back into consciousness. Clearly, someone had cracked open his skull, filled it with 15 pounds of rancid cow shit, then sealed it back up with a nail gun. That's how bad it hurt. He could barely see. He heard a strange cracking sound. Sort of like a fire in a fireplace, but not quite. Emergency lighting dimly lit up the hallway. Bits and pieces of ceiling, dirt, and chunks of glass covered the floor. Johnny looked at Day, who was holding his left arm with his right hand. Blood spots stained the left sleeve of his white lab coat. "Day," Johnny said. "What's going on?"
"I don't know," Day said quietly. "Chanterelle is dead."
That pushed Johnny's pain away until it was a far-off echo.
"What? Dead?"
Day nodded to Johnny's left.
"Look for yourself."
His voice sounded thick with sadness, pain, and confusion. Johnny looked left. Chanterelle had fallen off the railing above. She'd landed on her head. She lay glassy-eyed in a pool of blood. Her once beautiful face was a ruin, the right side of her temple smashed flat like the shell of a hard-boiled egg dropped on the floor. She'd landed there, all their weight coming down on that one spot, then rolled onto her back. Johnny had never seen death. Not human death, anyway. When he'd been in his early 20s, his dog Mooch had run away. Mooch got hit by a car, then was picked up by a state trooper and taken to a vet. The dog's back was broken. The vet had put Mooch down before even calling the number on the dog's collar tag. Johnny's number. By the time Johnny got the message, the dog had been put in a freezer. His one face-to-face experience with tragic death was a frozen dog corpse. While that had been horrible, it was nothing like looking at the dead woman lying in a pool of her own blood not 5 feet from you. A few moments ago, she'd been a genius helping to change the world. She'd been beautiful. Now she was just dead.
"Holy shit, Day," Johnny said. "What the fuck happened?"
"Chanterelle fell and I broke my arm. That's what happened."
"No, I mean, what happened? Did something explode?"
"I don't know. I can't reach the surface, and by that I mean, like, at all. No TV signals, no radio, no internet, no nothing. The elevator is totally fucked. I think something big blew up on the surface."
Johnny's stomach flipped.
"You think it's..."
His voice trailed off, but Day knew what Johnny was asking. Day nodded.
"There's radiation. Some of the rad counters from the surface are still working. We're getting rads down here, but it's not too bad."
"So the plant didn't melt down?"
"Not yet, at least,"
Day said.
"Can't say for sure. Something big went off up there. The rads could be from the reactor's core, or they could be..."
Now Day trailed off. He didn't want to finish. Johnny swallowed. It hurt his head to do even that.
"Day, did we get nuked? You think the Saudis launched nukes?"
Day shrugged.
"I don't think that's it. We wouldn't be here. Maybe a dirty bomb. I don't know. I don't know how we're going to find out, man. We're stuck down here."
"We have to call the surface."
Day looked at the dirty glass-strewn floor.
"I told you, man. There is no way to do that. Everything is out. Everything. And if we have a measurable rad count down here, that means up on the surface, it's bad, Johnny. If anyone lived through whatever hit us, which I doubt is possible, then they're cooking alive from radiation. Even if we could reach the surface, there's no one to reach."
If Johnny Paltrese had been standing, he would have sat down. As it was, he stayed where he was, right on his ass. That strange crackling sound seemed louder. It echoed through the long hall.
"What's that noise?"
Day shrugged.
"Beats the fuck out of me,"
he said. He used the heel of his foot to slowly draw abstract symbols on the dirt scattered across the floor. Johnny again looked at Chanterelle's body. looked at the ant sitting next to her head. Minimas were as big as the end of his thumb, workers with the size of his thumb including the big pad, but this specimen was as big as his whole hand, from the tip of his index finger down past his wrist. That measurement didn't even count the pair of mandibles, each of which were as long as his pinky. If Johnny picked it up, he'd need two hands to hold it. This one was a soldier.
"Day, look," Johnny said quietly.
Day looked at Johnny, then to Chantrell's body.
"Oh," he said. "That's not good."
Johnny looked at the ant tank. Huge cracks ran up and down the thick glass like a model of translucent tectonic plates. In some spots, the glass was gone entirely, replaced by a negative space surrounded by sharply undulating shards that reflected the red emergency lighting in 1,000 ruby facets.
"The ant tank broke," Johnny said.
Day gently picked up a big shard of glass, a shard as big as a butcher knife, then held it up for Johnny to see.
"Gee, you think?"
He put the shard in his pocket.
"How long have I been out?"
"About 3 hours, I think,"
Day said.
"I was out a while myself."
3 hours. Johnny got up slowly. It wasn't like the ant was going to attack or anything, but it was still bigger than a tarantula, and when you saw something bigger than a tarantula with pinchers the size of your pinky, you tended to move with caution. Johnny tested the black switchback stairs that led to the metal deck 20 feet above. The stairs were twisted and bent, but they seemed stable. He took the stairs one at a time, just to be sure. The farther up he went, the louder the crackling sound. He reached the deck, also bent, but also stable. Johnny looked out at the ground level of Nest 17. No greenery. All brown. The sawgrass was gone, all of it. Even the tree had been stripped clean of leaves. The tree looked much smaller, much thinner. Was the tree black? In the red light, the trunk and branches seemed to wiggle and writhe. Ants covered the tree. As Johnny watched, he heard that familiar cracking noise. One of the branches fell off and hit the ground.
"Day?"
he called down.
"Yeah?"
Day called up.
"I think maybe we need to get out of the hall."
"Why's that?"
"Because the ants ate all the sawgrass. Now they're eating the tree, and the tree's almost gone."
Day's leg was broken. It took them 30 minutes to reach the main control room, the same place Johnny had been sitting when that ant had called him a douche. Like everywhere else, the only illumination came from the emergency lighting's red glow. Bits and pieces of ceiling tiles had fallen here and there. A couple of computers had sailed off of decks and smashed on the ground, but overall, it wasn't that bad. Johnny set Day into the main control chair.
"See what systems are still online," Johnny said. "Someone's got to come for us soon. We need to see how long we can hold out."
Day nodded and started working the keyboard with his one good hand. Johnny tried two more computers before he found one that worked. He tried to think of their situation as a problem that needed to be solved. What resources did they have? What harmful conditions needed to be managed or mitigated? And how could they maximize their ability to stay alive until someone came for them? Day turned in his chair.
"Backup batteries are still online."
"How much power? How long will they run?"
Give me a second. Let me adjust for what systems are out."
Johnny typed commands to call up the internal cameras. In typical A.U. Rookman fashion, everything in the facility was watched and recorded from at least three angles. Rookman did not like investing millions of dollars to see someone steal information or to have someone sabotage the experiment.
"No good," Day said. "If everything were fully operational, we'd have 3 days of power."
"Calculate emergency lighting only," Johnny said. "Shut down everything except this room, the kitchen, and the hallway to walk back and forth between the two. We need water to the control room bathroom, but that's it. We'll sleep here."
"What about normal lighting in here, at least? It's fucking spooky in here, man. If we keep it normal only in here, the power should last a week at least."
Would they need more than a week? Maybe they could go with normal lighting for a few days, just until they reached someone and got some kind of estimate on rescue.
"Sure," Johnny said. "Normal lighting, but only in here."
Day typed in commands with just his right hand. The control room flickered to partial normal illumination, courtesy of the few unbroken lights. Still, it was better than that red glow. The kitchen held a lot of food, enough for the whole staff to eat for 3 or 4 days without leaving. With just Day and Johnny left, the food would last 2 weeks at least, as long as the refrigerator had power. Thanks to the damage, it took Johnny a good 20 minutes to bring up the camera network. Most of the cameras were out, but with all the redundancy built into the system, they still had coverage over most of the facility.
"I see a power drain," Day said. "Camera system online. Do we really need that?"
"For now, yeah. Keep it powered."
"Okay. How about the systems monitoring the nests?"
That made Johnny pause. The nests. They had just reached the breakthrough, proven that the experiment worked and potentially solved the world's energy crisis. Not that Rookman would bring such a thing to market, of course. Johnny was liberal-minded, but no fool. Rookman would keep pimping oil until the wells ran dry. But that really didn't matter anymore. When the oil did run out, Rookman's aunts provided the solution. A permanent, self-perpetuating solution. Johnny and Day owed it to the world to keep things going.
"Run a full analysis of all the nests," he said. "Once that's done, run a full backup of all data, especially the genetic sequences of Nest 17's queen, just to make sure we have everything."
"Running."
The main backup was connected via a cable that ran to a buried computer bunker more than 2 miles away. That bunker was even deeper than the fucked-up place Johnny and Day found themselves now. The backup bunker had been built by the same company that engineered Saddam Hussein's underground warrens. It could literally handle a direct nuclear strike.
Johnny? Come take a look at this."
Johnny walked over to Day's computer.
"What is it?"
"Look at this chart for the sweat grid in Nest 17.
Day pointed at the screen. The simple historical line chart showed the amount of biomass stored in Nest 17's fungus grid. The fungus took a week or so to break down matter and turn it into sweat, so if you wanted to know how much potential energy was in the pipeline, so to speak, you needed to weigh the amount of matter sitting on the fungal grid. The line showed a steady increase, then at the end it spiked up at a sharp angle. Day put a finger on the end of the chart.
"What the fuck is that? You said they clear-cut their tank."
"They did.
Well, they've added 90 kilos of biomass in the past 3 hours.
"The tree?"
Day shook his head.
"The tree weighs 50 kilos tops. Even if they clear-cut all the grass, brought down the whole tree, that doesn't account for this spike. They're getting biomass from somewhere outside Tank 17.
Johnny's mouth ran dry. He reached for the keyboard and called up the cameras covering the main hallway. The picture flared to life. Chantrell was almost gone. Ants swarmed across what was left of her ravaged body. Both arms were completely gone, as was her left leg. Her right leg was nothing more than a few inches of stump. Her guts had spilled onto the floor all around her, oozing free after her stomach skin and muscle had been torn away. They had cut apart her skull. The remaining bits gleamed a bloody red-white in the emergency lighting. Like her guts, a gelatinous mass of brains spread out from the half-head.
30 minutes, Day said.
He sounded almost conversational, as if talking about a co-worker being chopped up by ants after a nuke went off above your underground lair was something that happened every day.
"It took them 30 minutes to do that. They can't take the soft parts, but they're taking everything else."
Just like the trail Johnny had seen up on the surface of Nest 17, Chantrell's body sat at the end of a thick, moving river of ants. The ants coming toward her walked through a trail of blood made by thousands of tiny footprints and leaking body parts. The trail led up the switchback black stairs and into a crack in the glass. The ants walking away from her also walked through that line of gore, but they didn't go back empty-handed, so to speak. Each one carried a ragged chunk of flesh, a bloody bit of bone, or some other semi-firm torn-up piece of Chantrell that Johnny couldn't identify. So many ants, all cutting into her. She literally shrank as they watched. Over half of her was gone. The rest of her wouldn't last much longer.
"At least she's not alive," Day said. That would really suck if you were alive and they cut you up like that."
Johnny looked at the chart again, at the spike rising sharply up.
"Wait a minute. Subtract the tree's weight and all the biomass we knew was in the tank. How much does that leave?"
Day typed one-handed.
"About 29 kilos. No, wait, that just tipped up to 30.
"How much did Chantrell weigh?"
Day shrugged.
"I don't know, maybe 50 kilos? What fucking difference does it make, Johnny?"
Johnny pointed to the computer screen showing Chantrell's ignominious demise.
There's a good 25 kilos of her left on the floor, so maybe they've taken 25 kilos of her into the nest and you've subtracted the tree and all the sawgrass. So where did the last 25 kilos of biomass come from?
Day thought for a second. Then he nodded and simply said,
"Fuck."
He reached out with his good hand and called up a dashboard that showed the status of all the nests. The dashboard showed three columns, labeled North 1 through 10, East 11 through 21, and West 21 through 30. Each column had 10 squares below it. Each square held a number denoting the nest and a status light that ranged from solid green, denoting an active and healthy nest, to red, denoting a nest in trouble, to black, denoting a dead nest. North showed two steady green lights. No change there. West showed three steady green lights, as did the newly seeded 21, 22, 23, and 24. Those seemed to be fine. No change. But in the east column, things had changed indeed. Before the explosion, that column showed nine bright green lights. Now it showed only one green light. Nest 17. Nests 11 and 12 showed flickering green lights, just starting to demonstrate flashes of red that showed a population experiencing some kind of stress. Nests 13 through 15 showed red lights, nests that were in serious trouble. Nests 16, 18, 19, and 20 showed black. Those nests were dead. Johnny called up the cameras for the Queen's Chamber in Nest 12. As soon as the image came up, he wished he hadn't called it up at all. Day let out a long whistle.
"Holy moly," he said. "That's fucked up."
Gigantic soldier bugs swarmed into the Queen's Chamber. There were also minimism workers and a few soldiers that seemed to fight these invaders, but all the ants looked the same. In the fuzzy glare of night vision, the Queen's Chamber was a teeming, indiscernible mass of greenish-white bodies on a green background. Johnny couldn't tell the combatants apart. The ants, however, didn't seem to have any problem separating friend from foe.
"The sawgrass," Day said. "Nest 17 wants the plants in all the tanks. They're killing the competition."
Johnny shook his head.
"No. No way. We didn't program the AI for that. How the fuck could ants know to kill competitors for limited resources?"
Day shrugged.
"The Nest 17 ants cleared out their own cell, man. The windows must be cracked in the other cells, so now the chlorophyll sensors can detect the sawgrass in those. The AI is just doing what it's supposed to do. Stare the ants to available food."
The status light for Nest 12 stopped flickering from green to red. It now glowed a steady red. In the chamber, gigantic soldier ants snapped their pincers, each snap crushing the life out of an enemy. The screen, fully green with movement, gradually slowed as the corpses piled up. Ruined bodies twitched slightly, beads of life fluid leaking out of crushed heads, thoraxes, and abdomens. The status dashboard for the east column stopped showing green altogether. Nests 19 and 20 went black. Nests 11 and 12 moved to a solid red. Nests 13 through 15 started to flicker, only it was a flickering between a bright red and the nothingness of black. The Nest 17 soldier ants swarmed in toward the queen of Nest 12, killing everything in their path. Her radius of defense gradually shrank until the soldiers came within reach of her 3-inch-long mandibles. She snapped those mandibles, cutting the first Nest 17 soldier clean in half. Three soldiers broke free of her defenders and closed in. She took out another, the very end of her mandibles, punching through the soldier's thorax. She lifted it up off the ground. Its little legs spasmed in instant death throes, but the remaining two soldiers moved in past her uplifted jaws. The soldier's mandibles weren't as long as the queen's, but at 2 inches long and backed up by the muscles in the soldier's huge heads, they were enough to do the job. One pair closed on the queen's cell phone-sized head, denting her exoskeleton. She dropped her second victim and tried to back away, to pull free. When she did, the other soldier bit down where her head met her thorax. It was probably an accident.
"The luck of the draw," Johnny thought.
Even mutated monster ants were still ants, for fuck's sake. They didn't know enough to cut off a queen's head. But that's exactly what happened. Her head fell to the ground. Free of that weight, her body scrambled backward for a few steps until it hit the chamber wall, then it fell on its side, big legs kicking randomly. The status light for Nest 12 went black. So did the other nests, leaving the east column a dead black save for the steady green light of Nest 17.
"They're killing everything," Day said. "It's not just biomass they want. There's plenty of chanterelle left if they've just wanted biomass. I can't explain it, but the nest, not the AI, has decided to wipe out anything that moves.
I hate to break it to you, Mang, but we're kind of fucking fucked right now.
Johnny nodded. Fucked right about now seemed like a very accurate term. Johnny and Day would have to move back and forth to the kitchen. Sooner or later, the predatory ants would try and attack them.
We gotta get to the kitchen, Johnny said. We gotta get as much food as we can into the control room, then seal it up.
You go, Day said.
He stared at the screen.
I'll stay here, keep an eye on things.
Day, come on, we've got to get our shit together.
Day laughed.
Don't worry about shit, El Dusha Bag, because shit is soft and the ants can't take the soft parts.
He just kept staring at the screen, at the wriggling, steadily shrinking pile of what used to be Chanterelle. Johnny opened his mouth to plead again, then stopped. He didn't have time to convince Day. He had to hurry. As long as the ants of Nest 17 were tied up with Chanterelle with the other ant nests, he could probably get to the kitchen without running into any of them. Johnny reached past Day and called up the control that showed the hallway just outside the control room door. No ants. Johnny ran into the hall and headed for the kitchen. He moved as quickly as he could, carrying the weight of two canvas bags filled with canned goods. He grabbed all the cans he could carry and two can openers, just in case one failed. He hadn't brought anything perishable. He could just eat right out of the cans. That would save not only on what he needed to carry, but also on any energy they might need for cooking. He turned the corner and stopped cold. Ants. Not a lot of them, and not the big soldiers. These were workers, just five of them, wandering around the floor. Wait, six, because there was one on the wall. They weren't a column. They were scouting. Scouting for more food. Johnny started to run, but after only five heavy steps, he put on the brakes. The ants had all turned to face him, turned when he stepped. They could feel the vibrations of his feet. Johnny stood still, hoping they would move on. Then one started moving in his direction. It moved a little forward and to the left, then turned, moving forward and to the right.
Scouting. Scouting for the source of the vibrations.
Johnny Paltrice was being hunted.
Well, fuck that. Johnny was the human here. These were ants. Big fucking ants, to be sure, but still ants.
He took two steps forward and stomped his left foot. The worker ant crunched, exploding like a thumb-sized jelly donut. The other four ants on the floor scurried towards him. The one on the wall scampered down. Johnny stepped toward the second ant, planted his left foot, and almost slipped from the squished ant slime still on the sole of his shoe. He regained his balance and stomped down with his right, killing a second ant. He dropped both bags, spilling canned goods across the floor, then jumped in the air with both feet and came down on the third ant. Strands of insect fluid shot across the floor. Something on his right calf. Johnny kicked with his left foot, kicked at his own calf. He felt the ant come free, but he almost lost his balance again. He stumbled, then planted his left foot to regain control. The gut-strewn sole slid, and his foot shot out from under him. He fell, hitting the ground hard, the back of his head bonking against the concrete floor. Pain swelled up in his skull, a flashing roar that wiped out all thought. But he had to think. He had to get up. There were still some ants. He had to get up. Johnny Paltrice rolled to his hands and knees. Before he could rise, he felt the pain in his left hand. Searing pain in his left middle finger. His left hand shot up to his chest, pulling away from the pain like he'd touched an oven burner. He was on his feet before he knew what he was doing and running only a split second after that. As he sprinted, his right hand covered up his left and felt the hot wetness of blood. The red emergency lights lit the last 30 feet between him and the control room. He used his right hand to try and open the door, but his blood-slick skin slipped on the doorknob. He wiped his palm against his pant leg, then re-gripped the doorknob, opened it, ran in, and shut it behind him. Johnny stumbled forward, head thick with the pain that seemed to take up his whole hand. Again clutching his left hand with his right, he sat his ass on a desk, pulled his feet up, and stood. Standing on the desktop, he looked at the door, waiting for them to come through. He saw no movement. What he saw instead was a trail of blood, a trail leading from the door to the desk upon which he stood. Johnny Paltrace didn't want to look at his hand. He knew what he'd see. But he had to look because that's what you do when you're hurt. He held up his hand. His left middle finger was gone, cut clean off just below the first knuckle, leaving only a stab, pulsing soft gurgles of blood.
Oh, fuck, he said.
His finger,
Fucking gone. Not just gone, but out there in the hall, where the ants were probably already taking it back to the nest. Johnny stared at the bleeding stub. With his right hand, he gathered up the end of his white lab coat and pushed hard on the stub. He let out a small scream, then choked it off. Of course it hurt like dipping the whole hand in acid, but he had to stop the bleeding.
Day? Johnny said, still staring at the door. Day? Do you see any ants in here?
Day didn't answer.
Day, do you see any goddamn fucking ants in here, goddammit?
Day still didn't answer. Johnny couldn't look away from the door, but he had to. Day wasn't answering. But what if he looked away from the door and they came through right then, slid under the door maybe, or came in some other way, followed the trail of blood and came after him again?
Day, stop fucking around and answer me!
Again, nothing. Johnny forced himself to turn, to look away from the door, away from the last barrier against the ants. His hand hurt so goddamn bad. Could he stop the bleeding? Of course he could, just direct pressure. Just a finger.
Just a finger. Go fuck yourself, Johnny. It's not just a finger, it's your fucking middle finger. How are you going to type your D's without your middle finger?
He looked at Day, who sat in the chair before the main terminal. Back turned to the door. Back turned to Johnny. Day wasn't moving.
Day?
Johnny looked at the floor under Day's chair. No ants, but there was a puddle of blood. A big puddle of blood.
Oh, no.
Still jamming his bloody lab coat to his finger stub, still feeling every ounce of agony, Johnny Peltries hopped down and walked slowly toward Day. Day still wasn't moving. Johnny had to walk into the puddle of blood to look down on his co-worker. Day's eyes stared out glassy and black. His hands hung at his sides, almost to the floor. Each of his wrists showed a deep gash running from the base of the hand all the way up to the elbow. His open palms also showed big lacerations. Then Johnny saw it. In the puddle of blood on the floor, he saw the broken shard of glass from the window, the shard Day had taken when they left Chantrell's body. This couldn't be happening. Couldn't be. Johnny could not be alone down here. Alone.
Day, what the fuck did you do? What the fuck are we going to do? That was really stupid, man. Come on, get up, get up. Now that was really stupid. We have to do something.
Day didn't get up. So much blood. A crackling noise. Johnny's head snapped to look at the door, but he saw nothing. Or did he? Was that door moving? Maybe a little. The trail of blood running from the door to the desk drew his attention again. Man, he'd bled a lot. How was he going to type his D's? Could he spell dumb with just Would people get that? The blood trail. Big splatters, not quite a solid line, but not far from it. He would have bled like that in the hall, too, a line of blood leading from the hall right into the control room. No, not a line. A trail. A loud snap punctuated the crackling sound. At the bottom of the door, Johnny saw a quick flash of something. Something small, something narrow, something black. A piece of the door vanished. A small piece, only a quarter inch, maybe, right from the bottom, the fresh white wood showing against the gray paint. Then more flashes of black. Another piece. Then another. More black. Lots of black. The hole was a half inch now, almost big enough for them to come through, to follow the trail of blood.
Go away, Johnny said quietly. I know you think I'm a douche, but I'm not, because I can't type my D's. I'm just an oosh, so go away.
The ants didn't listen.
Author's note for you social networking. Ever since I can remember, I have been fascinated with ants. As a child, the concept of a group of insects cooperating to achieve tasks that an individual insect could never accomplish mesmerized me. Just so I don't sound like I'm posturing here, at the same time in my life, I was also picking my nose a lot and laughing at farts. So there's that. To this day, eusocial insects hold a special place in my mind. They're little collective groups that are so much like our own human cooperative cultures. You can't build a car on your own from scratch, but thanks to division of labor, you can get a job and make enough money to buy a car that is made by thousands of other people. That level of specialization is only found in one other group of creatures on our planet, eusocial animals. The thing that boggles my little mind is that eusocial insects are born with these instructions pre-programmed. They don't learn how to harvest or how to soldier. They don't learn how to gather nectar from flowers or tend to the queen. They just do it. One queen produces all of the casts necessary for colony survival. Every time I look at eusocial animals, even to this day, the two words that constantly go through my mind are holy and shit. So, I'd always wanted to write about them. I touch on the eusocial structure with the Quiss species for my stories The Crypt and the GFL series, but I never got down and dirty with the awesomeness that is ants. My good friend J.C. Hutchins, a talented novelist and podcaster, wrote a fantastic modern-day sci-fi series called Seven Sun. To promote this series, he created an anthology of stories set in the Seven Sun timeline titled Seven Sun Obsidian. He asked me to contribute, and I was in. In the Seven Sun timeline, there's a major terrorist event on U.S. soil. I won't tell you what it is, because I hate spoilers, but it is a spectacular and ballsy thing to do in a thriller story. The storyline involves a major power company, Rookman Oil, so I took advantage of the opportunity to create a story that had been in my mind for many years, using leafcutter ants as biofuel harvesters. I'm fascinated with the idea of self-replication for industrial purposes. If we can make something that makes copies of itself from scratch, and this something produces a valuable raw material, then we have a nearly infinite potential to create a self-renewing supply of that raw material. We already do this to some extent with bees and honey. As you saw in the story, leafcutter ants harvest plant material, use that material to cultivate a crop of specialized fungus, then eat a byproduct of that fungus. Ants farm, for crying out loud. How awesome is that? If we could tweak the ants to eat a high-energy plant material, then tweak the fungus to produce a byproduct that is suitable for the creation of biodiesel, then boom, you have completely cut humans out of the production cycle of harvesting that crop and converting it into crude. I'd had the idea for quite some time, and in 2009 was able to buckle down and turn it into a Chomp Chomp story for Hutchins. Since then, I've been pleased and excited to see that this idea has real traction in the energy industry. Well, sort of. Scientists are studying how plant material breaks down inside of the ant colony, and also examining several species of fungus in hopes of finding one that does exactly what I talk about in eusocial networking. So far, I haven't seen anyone apply the concept of actually using the leafcutter ants to do the collection work, but I think it is a real possibility. It comes down to the concepts of scale and expense. Can humans harvest more crops than ants? Yes, of course, but there are associated costs of equipment and labor. If you could get ants or other insects to do the harvesting, your primary labor force costs nothing. No wages, no healthcare, no union dues, etc. Ants don't need holidays or lunch breaks. Ants just work, all day, every day. You'd still need people for crop cultivation, of course, but the amount of ant colonies that could be seeded for harvesting is potentially limited only by the amount of available food, that crop that you are planting and cultivating. To sum it up, this is one of my favorite stories. I have some cool concepts wrapped up in a science-gone-horribly-wrong format, tied together by fun characters. I enjoyed writing it, and I hope you enjoyed reading it.
You have been listening to The Bones Are White serialized short story audiobook, written by Scott Sigler. This audiobook was produced by A. Kovacs and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. For more information on the author or to hear his free weekly fiction podcast, go to scottsigler.com. Theme music is the song Greed by the band Separation of Sanity.
I am a creeping cancer, rot you to the core, pumping through your blackened heart, seduction of your soul, separation of your senses, sanity, your currency. I am your rolling gun, on your knees, kisses green.
every 5 minutes. A transplant candidate dies while waiting for a compatible heart, liver, or kidney. Imagine a technology that could provide those life-saving transplant organs for a high price, and imagine what a company would do to monopolize that technology. On a remote island in Lake Superior, a team of geneticists unlocks this holy grail of medicine by reverse engineering the genomes of all mammals, creating an animal with organs perfectly suitable for human transplantation. They envisioned a docile herd animal, but one team member had another, darker vision. This ancestor is anything but docile. The team's work spawns something big, something evil, something very, very hungry. Ancestor is a complete serialized fiction podcast by number one New York Times bestselling novelist Scott Sigler, with all episodes available. Binge the entire story now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.